in our already overstuffed warehouse. There's mattresses, recliners, sofas, love seats, dining rooms, bedrooms. There's way too much to list. Some clearance items are up to 60% off. I challenge you to not find something you want at a great price. We have what you want and we need to sell it. The nice thing is, when you find it, it's in stock. It's right there in front of you. It's ready for delivery. Come to Wendell's in Colchester today and take advantage of our overstock of great furniture. 0% financing and delivery available. Check us out at wendellsfurniture.com.
Come to Wendell's. We make deals. Wendell's Furniture.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A little snow out there, even as I speak. A little sloppy out there on the highways. Make sure you leave yourself a little bit of extra time. Road crews did a nice job today, but don't depend on that. Slow down a little bit. Give everybody a chance out there. Coming up on the program this morning, in our second hour today, I'm looking forward to our discussion. It's going to be kind of a one-way discussion with State Senator Phil Baruth, who's going to be joining us in a slightly different capacity, that as a writer. Phil was one of four people that put on or submitted a story to tell at a recent event up in Burlington, The Winter Tales. If you ever get a chance to go to it, Vermont Stage Company does a great job. You might want to check that out. And so I asked Phil if he would be kind enough in the holiday season here to come down and share his story with us. It focuses on Swedish Christmas traditions. And, of course, like a complete idiot, I asked him to come on the program tomorrow on Christmas Eve, which he then reminded me is the main day that the people of Swedish descent really focus on Christmas. So he's going to join us today. That was nice of him to gently remind me. We'll take your phone calls throughout the program as well, too. Love to hear from you at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. We'll also feature a little holiday music today and tomorrow, featuring my fabulous dentist, Dr. Randy Miller, who's an incredibly multi-talented guy. Can fill a cavity and also fill a hall of people for music. He and his two kids, his two sons, will be featuring some of their music. It's beautiful. Our numbers on the program, 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. All right, warning here. We're going to talk about a kind of a heavy topic here to begin the program. But like the heavy topics that we talk about, I think it's an important one. And let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Stephanie Fast, who has been an advocate on the issue of orphans. And there is an estimated 143 to 153 million orphans worldwide, a great number of them under the age of five. And Stephanie has written about this in a book called She Is Mine, and she's kind enough to join us live in the line from just outside of Portland, Oregon this morning. Thank you for joining us, Stephanie. How are you this morning?
Awesome. Dark and dreary, but awesome.
You know, what's your choice in this kind of weather, right?
That's right. Yes.
Tell us your story. You have really suffered from what you talk about. Tell us about your backstory.
Well, of course, my early years were horrible. You know, war brings lots of issues to a lot of people, but one of the things that we forget sometimes is the children that suffer the most. And when a child loses their parents or a child is abandoned during a war, or like me, a child that is born biracial due to foreign soldiers coming to a country and getting involved with their girls, their life can be hell on earth. I was abandoned when I was four by my mother because she could not go on with the rest of her life with a biracial child as her daughter. She literally actually just put me on a train, and that's the last I saw of her. For the next 3 years, I went through hell. I was thrown into wells, thrown into septic wells, scavenged for food, live in snow camps, and live along bridges, and children's camps and was raped. You name it, I went through it, and I should not have survived in any way. But looking back on those years of my life, I realized that it was moments of kindness that gave me hope. Someone that just spoke life to me. And, you know, as a little girl, you're always hoping to find your mom again. And that was just the thing that kept me going. I was found on a garbage heap by a Swedish nurse and rescued, of course, by her, and then eventually adopted by an American couple.
Your father was who?
My father was an American soldier, I think.
Mm-hmm. So your mom, talk about the prejudice. You grew up in Korea. Talk about the prejudice towards people that are biracial. Why is that?
Well, I don't think the stigma is as much. The stigma in Korea now is just being a single woman, having a child, which seems, you know, not quite understandable for us here in the States. But back in the 50s, for the Asians in the 50s, the fact of ever really, you know, intermarrying with anyone or being involved with anyone outside of their own people was unthinkable. And they actually really thought of foreigners as being a foreign devil. And whether they appreciated them coming and fighting for them or not, being involved in their lives as family was unthinkable. And so a biracial child had no, what you would call, documentation. In Asia, a male member of the family has to register you in his family registry, and a biracial child had no rights to be in that family registry.
There were no relatives that would take you in?
Well, at the first years of my life, I mean, my memory is I think my mother came to a place where she couldn't take care of herself. So we did go live with like an uncle. You know, usually there was like a member of the family that would be, you know, the caregiver for the whole clan. And so we lived in this almost like a little compound. And when I say that is in Asia, they would have this courtyard with, you know, the main house and some couple of little houses that were connected to it. And I do remember cousins. I remember grandma vaguely. But my mom and I were sort of separated from them. And doing research for the book, I came to realize that these women were continually taunted by their family members to get rid of their child because they could not get married and have their, you know, future with a child like me.
Mm. How do you feel about your mom today?
Well, now, at this age, I have forgiven her. I realize that everyone has a story and everyone has a trauma, and how they deal with it is sometimes good and sometimes bad. And I think for her, she had no other choice. Well, when I was 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and wandering on the streets of Korea and, you know, in my spirit crying out for her and she wasn't there, I began to hate her.
Mm. When did you reach that point of forgiveness?
Not till I was really held my first baby in my arm and I felt the love of a mother. That was probably when it really registered. Oh my goodness, how can a mother do this? She must have been desperate to do this. I can't even imagine doing this to my child. But certainly the beginning of forgiveness started in my 20s, because I am a woman of faith, and I realized that for me to live in with joy and for me to live with acceptance, that I needed to forgive. But the actual realization, I can let go of expectations of her, I can let go of judgments of her, I can even bless her and pray for her, that did not come till I had my own children.
Well, that's so interesting, because you would think that there was a possibility that having a child would have accentuated the rejection and abandonment you must have felt.
Oh, no, the children can feel a really big, big, big hole in your heart.
Yeah. Did your peers treat you any differently? It sounds as though the adults were terrible. Were your peers any better?
Oh, no. You know, it's I mean, I look back now and I go, how in the world did they even know I look that different? You know, my eyes has a crease in it, which most Asians don't have. My hair had a lot of curl in it, which most Asians don't have. But beyond that, I look very, very Asian. You know, I'm not one of those blue-eyed, blonde, you know, biracial child. And so, but as a little girl, I really could not see myself. There were no mirrors. We didn't even have stained glass windows, you know, on the home. So I could never really see what I looked like. So I just thought I looked like this monster, you know, and that when children would taunt me, it was because of the way I looked or the way I smelled. But I mean, I have a vague memory one time, not vague, but a vivid memory of one time the children catching me and throw me into what I call a human septic well. And I have to explain that everybody had outhouses, and they would empty their outhouse to the main hole in the village.
Oh,
and that's what the farmers would use to fertilize their fields in the spring. You know, we always call it the honey bucket smell, right? And the children literally threw me into that well, and I remember the awful stench and feeling like that. I am nothing but human waste, yeah.
Wow. We're talking with Stephanie Fast. She's the author of She Is Mine. She talks about the worldwide number of orphans. You know, it was interesting. One of the contrasts that you make is the number of missing children out there compared to orphans. Why is that an important contrast to make?
Well, I think so often, you know, we lump everybody together. We lump, you know, whether they have family or not, if they're out on the streets, that's sort of an orphan calculation. But there are so many children that come from poverty. There are children that are missing. There are children that are trafficked that is not in that number. When I say 143 million orphans, these are children that have lost their families and have no one to care for them.
Mm-hmm. 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. You said that there were moments of hope in this. I mean, thank God, Stephanie. What were some of those?
Well, I think children have an amazing capacity to survive. And children have amazing capacity for hope. For me, you know, I'll just tell you a story. I remember stealing food. Stealing food in Korea would be like someone going to your bank account here and stealing all your money, because that's how precious food was to the Koreans after the war. And I had to steal to survive. And so these group of farmers literally actually tied me to a water wheel. And I remember that sense of, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And then someone, and I to this day, I don't know who this someone was, and I knew he wasn't a farmer because his hand wasn't rough like a farmer's.
Mm-hmm.
He untied me off the water wheel, and he placed me on the ground and cleaned me up as best as he could. By this time, my eyes had swollen, you know, my skin had been scraped off, and I was very, very weak and almost ready to die. And I'll never forget, as he held me in his arms, him saying to me, little girl, you listen to me. This is very, very important. You must live. You must live. And you know, as a little girl of five, or I don't really know exactly how old I was, but just that sound saying, you must live. And as a little girl thinking, well, I got to live because my mom was looking for me. And although it was a false hope, it still gave me hope to go on.
Mm. So did you ever make a big search for your mother?
Oh, yes, every day. That was my goal in life, you know. From the time I was abandoned, my goal was, you know, I need to find my mom. But, of course, eventually, in my wanderings, I probably wandered too far away from where I had started and just sort of gave up that search.
Did you ever run into anybody that you knew, and any friends, relatives, anybody, while you were in your wanderings?
No. I think the train had taken me too far for that.
Wow. Wow. You know, it's just remarkable that you're able to forgive your mother. I just need you to help educate me more about how you can go through that process and come to that conclusion.
Well, for me, again, I said I'm a woman of faith. I put all my confidence in the one that created me. And that was a major turning point in my life. And I did that as a late teenager. Up until then, I sort of wore this mask of being happy on the outside, but being miserable on the inside. I had this deep, deep secret that I didn't want anyone to know. Even my adopted parents, they knew something wasn't right, but I never talked about it, you know, because if I talked about it, they would reject me too, right? That was my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a late teenager, I gave my heart to God, and yet I still had all that pain there. But, you know, the thing about it is when you have faith is you reach for things that seems impossible and you hold him accountable. It's not just you making those steps. You hold him accountable. And I remember just saying to him over and over, God, I need to take what you say and match it to what I feel. It's just, they're so opposite. I need to bring it together. So it was a very small step-by-step forward. And I knew one of the things that for me to live a free life was to forgive. And that just sort of sounds, you know, people say forgive, but we don't really know what that really feels like. But, you know, forgiveness has four parts, I believe. You say, I forgive continuously. I believe sometimes forgiveness is a lifetime event. Second, you have to let go of expectations of that person you're forgiving. And third, for me, I needed to let go of judgments of them. You know how we say, I forgive you, but there's still an expectation that they're going to change, or they're going to say they're sorry, or they're going to, you know, come and find you. And I had to let go of that. And third was my judgments of them, my hatred of them, my anger of them, my bitterness towards them. And then fourth, I needed to pray for them. And so I began to pray for my mother in my 20s. And as I began to pray for her, I found my heart began to change. And I began to see her as a person. And I began to see that she was broken just as I was broken. And she made choices according to her brokenness.
Wow.
So when you begin to see the humanity in the person that you hated so much at one time, and you realize she's not really much different from you, it's quite easy to forgive.
Wow. That's remarkable. That's remarkable. I mean, it also, you know, you used the word liberated. There was a liberation that you probably felt. I mean, to be consumed by that anger or, you know, whatever that you would feel after the rejection. I mean, that's got to be, that has to be liberating. You don't have that monkey.
Oh, it is liberating. You know, I mean, I base a lot of my faith on a book called The Bible, and there's a wonderful story in there about a servant that owed so much money to his master that he had no way of paying it back. And the master paid him back, but because his heart was still bound, to his fellow servants, you know, he was just, give me, give me, give me, because somehow in his mind he thought he still had to pay back, you know, this master that said, no, I forgive you. And when the master finds out, he puts him in a tormentor's chamber. But, you know, it's that tormentor's chamber is actually a heart of unforgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we're in that, I can't forgive you, you have done me wrong, we're the ones who suffer. They don't suffer. You know, we wish they suffered,
right,
but they don't. We're the ones who suffer. Yeah.
Did you do this on your own? Did you get help to reach that?
Not professional help. Now, later in life, I did go for some professional help because there were some deep internal issues that I needed to deal with. But in my 20s and early 30s, I had a community of people that I could trust, that I could share my story with, and they helped me.
Mm-hmm. Wow. 244-1777 is our local number. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. We're talking with Stephanie Fast, who grew up in Korea as a biracial child, was abandoned by her mother and really rejected by her own society. So the couple that adopted you, initially, I don't know how to describe this, Stephanie, you didn't immediately take to them. Is that fair to say?
No. I had been so especially abused by men, you know, in the few years that I had wandered the streets. My orphan papers basically said, my emotions were dead. I didn't respond to people emotionally very much anymore. I think my spirit was still alive, looking back in those days. Because I remember, like, you know, I still had hope, but physically I certainly, and emotionally I wasn't there. I had seen American soldiers, you know, after the war, thousands of soldiers still stayed in Korea to protect South Korea. And I knew what foreigners looked like. But when this couple came to the orphanage, I never saw such a huge man in my life. I mean, he's not that big. He was like 6'2" and weighed about 200 pounds. But for a little 30-pound orphan, you know, that's like a giant.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched this man. I had never seen a man like this. And I saw him pick up a little baby out of a little basket and tuck it under his neck. And I describe it as like that baby sort of, you know, disappeared under his neck because he was so big. And I saw him crying. And I, for the life of me, I could not understand why a man was crying over an abandoned baby. And so I came a little closer. And by now, you know, I'm almost 9 years old. And so, you know, I can think a little better. And I saw him put that baby down, pick up another baby, talk to his wife in English. And, you know, they were both emotional. And I just could not understand. And he saw me from the corner of his eyes. And although I was in an orphanage, the orphanage in the late 50s could not take care of all the needs that the children had. The orphanages were just packed to the brim, and so we still had a lot of the effects of the streets on us. And I was not what you would call a potential child to look at. And they were a young couple wanting to adopt a little baby boy. But he came over to where I was, and he stretched out his hand, and he touched my cheek. And I'm a grandma now, you know? And I think back to that moment, and I go, oh my goodness, I know the difference between a right touch and a wrong touch. And that touch that he touched me with his hand on my cheek was the right touch. My heart responded to it, and yet my body wanted to run away from it, but I couldn't. You know, I looked into his eyes, and I remember my heart sort of saying, don't let go, don't let go, this is good, this is good. But I did what I knew best, and I yanked the hand off my face, and I spit on him. And the miracle of it is, they went back home, they thought about it, they tried to talk God out of it, but they came back 24 hours later and adopted me as their daughter.
Wow. Then what happened? Tell me what happened next.
Well, they took me home, and they tried to clean me up as best they could. It took about 6 months for them to, you know, get rid of the lice in my hair, to put salves on my body, to get rid of the worms in my stomach. They took me to a missionary doctor to correct my lazy eye and, you know, just. But I kept waiting for them to put me to work because the orphanage director had sort of hinted that I was going to go as a bond servant, you know, because when you got to be 9, 10, and 11 in an orphanage, oftentimes a rich family would come and get you and use you as a servant. And that's what I was sort of thinking, you know, that this American couple was going to use me as a servant, but they kept bathing me all the time. I never had a bath in my life, and you know, they would feed me all the time, and they had this little thing called the bed that I would roll out of every night. And, you know, they had a little flush toilet that I would just empty the tank because my dad had built a tank up on the roof for, you know, to flush the toilet. And I just didn't understand that I was adopted. And finally, a worker that worked with my, or a student actually at the university that my father was teaching at, said to me that I was adopted, that I was their daughter. And I remember running up the hill to the little house that my parents were living in saying, I'm their daughter? I'm their daughter? I don't understand. And that's when it really began to dawn on me that they weren't going to take me back to the orphanage, that I was going to live with them, and I wasn't going to be a servant.
Wow, wow. So did you go to university or anything?
Yes, later in life, yes.
And where did the family live?
Well, my parents came back to when I was 12 years old to the States, and my dad was what you call an itinerant pastor. He was a missionary in Korea. So we actually lived in several places, Texas, Tennessee, Georgia, Indiana, Illinois.
Wow. What a varying group of places to live.
I know. Crazy people in all of them.
Did you feel... go ahead.
No, but, you know, I think for me it was good because I saw a variety of people and the people were also kind to me. But, you know, I came to the States thinking, oh, now I'm an American, right? I'm going to look like an American. I'm going to act like an American. But because I was adopted quite late, you know, I still had sort of that Korean grow that I can't get rid of. And back in the 60s, there just wasn't diversity of people as there is now in the States. And so the place that we lived in, Texas, there were, of course, a lot of Hispanics and whites, a little bit of black, but not too many Asians. I was the only Asian in the school. Same thing in Georgia. I was the only Asian in the school. Same thing in Indiana and Illinois. And, you know, they would always distinct me as being, you know, Chinese or something like that. And it was like, I so wanted to just be American.
Yeah.
But I thought being American was like being looking like my mom and dad white.
Mm. Are your adopted mom and dad still alive?
My mother is alive and doing very, very well in Nashville, Tennessee. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay. And do you stay in contact with her?
Oh, yes. I go down and see her often.
Uh-huh. These, talk about, boy, you know, you were so lucky. I mean, your story is so incredible. But what about all these other kids? What happens to these kids? What would have happened if this couple, say, hadn't come along when you were 9 or 10?
Well, for me, if I had not been rescued first off the garbage heap, I probably would have died. And that's what happens to a lot of abandoned children that is never recorded. A lot of the abandoned children, you know, their families either abandon them or their parents die. And the governments don't have the capability of keeping a record of these children. So many of these children just die, which is so, so sad. But if they should survive, many of them get sold into prostitution, or many of them become domestic help, or many of them become almost criminals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What if anything, is there that we can do about it?
Well, there are hundreds and probably thousands of organizations. And what I would say to a person that says, oh, I feel compelled to help one of these children is, you know, find an organization that works directly with the children that have been abandoned. Many, many orphanages, the children there really are not orphans. They are children that come from poor families, and they will eventually go back to the families if the parents can afford them. In the Eastern Bloc, like in Russian countries, many of them are almost trained to go into sex trade. And they are lost forever in this whole, you know, tunnel of sex trading. And so I would find an organization where your heart is compelled to. For my husband and I, we support organizations, and I'm an advocate and join with other organizations that work with children from the ground up. So if a child is found at the age of 3 and 4, they don't just keep them in the orphanage till they're 15 or 16. They actually take them right through adulthood. So to give them, you know, the training that they need to sustain their own life in the country of their birth.
Are there particular areas of the world this is worse than others?
I believe it's worse everywhere. But, of course, you know, there's a pocket of Asia just because of the population that's in Asia. That's very, very, probably has the greatest density of orphans. Africa, of course, has many, many orphans. Central America has many, many orphans. Haiti is a horrible country when it comes to orphans. That's one of the countries that we're quite involved in. But, you know, the foster care system in America is full of children that are never going to be reunited with their families. And so if you want to start locally, you know, look to the foster care and see if there's any children that you can either bring into your home as foster parents, realizing that they will come with some issues. You know, I think that's another thing is that we say, oh, I heard this lady's story. I want to adopt. But you don't realize that these children come with a lot of brokenness.
Yeah.
And so I always say to a family, don't adopt out of zeal. Adopt out of, you know, a passion inside and know that you are stable enough to face some of these issues that they're going to bring into your home.
You know, I'm glad you used the word broken because I think it's quite accurate, and it was a word that I was frankly hesitant to use, but I think you've proven that you can be fixed, right?
You can be fixed to a certain level, yes.
Because when you talk about then later in your life dealing with the deep internal issues that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, I'm guessing this might have gone back to what we've been talking about, right?
Right. Yes. Your heart is broken, your mind is broken, and in reality, your body gets broken. You know, you go through what you go through as a child, and you tell yourself, I can do this, I can do this. You know, science has said that your body retains all your memories.
Yeah.
And eventually, it has to give. And so, you know, I believe every human being to a certain point is broken, but, you know, there's different degrees of brokenness, right? But in the end, it's the person that's broken that has to make the choice to say, am I going to live with this brokenness? Am I going to live with this bitterness? Am I going to live with this hatred? Am I going to be a victim for the rest of my life? Or can I? And if I can, what are the steps that I can do to mend and heal these areas of brokenness? I believe that you can be healed, but in that healing, you will always have some flashbacks. I'm a grandma now, and I still have flashbacks. But definitely in those flashbacks and in those moments of depression, I come out of it a lot quicker now than I did when I was younger.
Wow. What an honor to speak with you. I really appreciate your time this morning, and thank you for a really powerful message of hope.
Well, I pray that everyone that reads the book recognizes that there are orphans out there and they have the ability, the people that read the book have the ability to do something to help one child.
Merry Christmas. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie Fast is the author of She Is Mine. It talks about her own experience as an orphan growing up in Korea. And also she, as we've been discussing, talking about what is really a worldwide epidemic of children that are really lost. What a story. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. Particularly good this time of the year. Reminds us all just how darn fortunate we are. Moment of your time for our friends at the Vermont Coffee Company. It is coffee roasted for friends. If you're looking for a nice gesture to make to a friend who may have invited you over, why not bring a bag of Vermont Coffee Company coffee with you? Why not go out and buy a few bags of it and call up a friend or two and invite them on over? Vermont Coffee Company coffee comes in a nice dark roast. There's a mild roast and a fabulous decaffeinated blend, too, with robust flavor. And you can find it at all the major co-ops, all the independent grocery stores out there, and also now at Shaw's and Hannaford's in much of our listening area as well, too. One of the really great things about Vermont Coffee Company coffee, you can easily order it online, have it go to your friends and relatives out of town. And you can do that with just a couple of clicks and coughing up your credit card number. So you can do that by going to their website at VermontCoffeeCompany.com, and they do make it really, really easy for you. So a nice little taste of Vermont you can send your friends way, and they'll appreciate it very much. You know, people out there that really like drinking coffee will love Vermont Coffee Company coffee. The only problem you're going to have is that they're going to be calling you up and asking you to send them more. Well, maybe they'll do it by themselves when after they get the one from you. Vermont Coffee Company Coffee, it is coffee roasted for friends. We'll take your calls this morning at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. Back after this.
Looking for a cost-effective way to get your message and image?